smell like lilacs and bergamot. A white blanket so used that the cotton fibers were shattering, but soft. The way the cheap ice pops they sold at the shitty little bodega at Carry and Lombard tasted. The sound of a feed in the next room of rain. It had been a long time since he'd thought about how the rain sounded in Baltimore. Violence, helpless pain, but cheap ice pops, too. A deep peace welled up in his gut, flowing out through him, lifting him up and out of his body. He relaxed into it. The thing in his throat was gone. Oh, no, that was never going to happen. It was sated. Back in the deep place where it belonged. He felt like the moment after orgasm, only better, deeper, more real. Eventually, he noticed Bobby wasn't kicking him anymore. He rolled onto his back, opened his eyes. There was blood on the bulkheads and the deck. His testicles felt like soccer balls made of agony. Drying blood glued his left eye closed. His throat ached and burned when he swallowed, but the thing was gone. Something was weird about his breathing, though. It took him a second to figure out what. It was that he wasn't the only one wheezing. Bobby sat with her back against the door. Her legs were spread a little, taking up the space. Her hands were on her knees. The little bleeding divots where the skin over her knuckles had split looked like art. Her hair was plastered to her neck, mostly by sweat. He looked at her, looking back at him. Neither one of them spoke for a while. The hum of the station was the only sound. "So," Bobby said, then took another couple breaths before she went on. "The fuck was that?" Amos swallowed. It hurt a little less this time. He tried to sit up, then thought better of it. There were even a few spatters of blood on the ceiling. One of them looked a little like a cartoon dog face. "I don't," he said, then gulped in another breath. "I don't want things. You know what I mean?" "Nope. People want things. They want kids, or they want to get famous or rich or something. And then they get all screwed up trying to get it. So I just don't want anything. Not like that." "All right," Bobby said. "Only I fucked up. Didn't even know I was doing it, but it got where I wanted a thing." He waited for the lump to come back to his throat, and when it didn't, he went on. "I want Peaches to get to die at home, with a family." "On the Rosie," Bobby said. "With us." "Yeah, I want that. Only ever since we got back from Freehold, it's all coming apart. It wasn't so bad when it was just Holden and Naomi peeling off on their own, because they picked that. And also, they never actually went away," Bobby said. "But then that big bastard came through the Laconia Gate, and now we're locked off the Rosie, and it's like the chance to do it right's just slipping too far away to get a hold of, you know? I see her acting like it's not much one way or the other, only it is to me. And then everything gets harder. I get cranky, start thinking about shit I don't want to think about, you know." They were silent for a long moment. Amos tried sitting up again and managed it this time. "All right," Bobby said. "I get it."
"You do?"
"Close enough," she said. "I get it close enough." She levered herself up to standing, then held a hand out to him. He took it, his hand on her wrist, hers on his. They pulled together and got him to standing. Her face was almost unmarked, but there were some bruises starting to show around her neck.
"You really beat the shit out of me," he said.
"It would have been easier to kill you," Bab said, and grinned with bloody teeth. "But I feel like we still need your dumbass." He nodded. She was right about both things.
"We should get you some ice," he said.
"Fuck you," she said. "If I did half my job, you'll be stuffing your jock with every cold thing we have."
"Yeah. You can have it when I'm done, though."
She managed another bloody smile and turned toward the door.
"Hey, Babs," he said. "No hard feelings, right? Just next time you need to beat someone up, how about you don't insult me first?"
He chuckled. It hurt.
"If I need to beat someone up, I've got a whole station full of possibilities. But if I'm looking to lose a fight, I'm pretty much down to just you."
She took a second. "Fair point." It took him about 5 minutes to get to the head. He washed up the best he could, but he was going to need some fresh clothes, and washing his eye pulled the clot a little bit loose. It started bleeding again. He talked to Saba about getting someone to stitch it closed. But clothes first. "Jesus Christ," Peaches said when he stepped into the room. "What happened?"
"Huh? Oh, you mean this? Me and Babs were doing a little sparring. I put my face where it shouldn't have been. It ain't nothing."
Her face balanced between not believing him and choosing to, despite the thinness of the lie. He looked at her collarbone, waiting for the thing to come up with some way to break it, but nothing came. So that was good.
"You need to be less rusty," she said at last.
"That's not wrong," Amos said.
"What are you up to?"
"I was going to go smear some food on my mouth like a toddler," she said.
"Sounds good," he said. "I'll go with you."
Chapter 40. Naomi.
"Wake up! We have to go," someone said. "Now! Go! Go! Go!"
Naomi forced her eyelids open. Her feet hit the decking before the dream she'd been in loosed its grip on her mind. There had been a fire. She had been talking to it. She felt herself forgetting, the dream dissolving like sugar floss in water. Amos rolled off his bunk with a grunt of pain and went to help Clarissa up. Alex was tugging his jumpsuit up over thin, brown legs. The new voice belonged to a girl too young for the split-circle tattoo on the back of her hands.
"What's going on?" Bobby said. "We got a problem?"
"Saba got word we need to go, so we go. Now go!"
"Where is he?"
Bobby asked.
"Gone,"
the girl said. And then she was gone, too. Light spilled into the bunk from the door she hadn't closed. The voices and sounds of metal against metal were loud and panicky, but they weren't battle. There wasn't gunfire. The fear and the urge to motion that grabbed Naomi's heart were still as violent.
"You good, Peaches?" Amos asked.
Clarissa nodded and pulled her hair back into a ponytail like she was getting ready to go to work. There was more color in her cheeks since she'd gotten the new medicine. If Amos hadn't found a supply, they'd have been carrying her right now. Heaven, small favors like that. They piled out into the corridor, and Naomi paused, looked back. There were no tools, no terminals, nothing left behind but traces of hair and DNA, which would be plenty enough to identify them.
"Naomi?" Alex said from the hall. "Everyone else is getting out mighty quick here. We should maybe..."
She moved quickly, decisively, pulling blankets and pillows and sheets up in her arms. They were cheap, so they pressed down to almost nothing. Another small favor. She shoved them into the makeshift recycler feed at the end of the hall. Maybe it wouldn't make a difference. Maybe she'd been foolish to take the time. It didn't matter. She'd done what she'd done.
A lot of her life was like that now. Saba was at the service doorway that led out to the rest of the station, the vast body of Medina that the underground didn't control. His jaw was tight, and there was a darkness around his eyes that the brown of his skin couldn't hide. "What's going on?" she asked. "Had a word from one of ours in system logistics. Laconia slated this section for survey. If they're going to find our holes here, best we not be in them." "Well, we knew it would come." He pressed a hand terminal into her palm. "This is yours. Cooked profile. Got one for Alesla along with. Rooms, jobs. Don't scratch the chrome, it'll come off, but it's what I could do fast." "Thank you," Bobby said as he passed one to her. "Messages too. Just text, and just to me. Your circle is your circle." Naomi nodded. It felt like being young again, in all the worst ways. Amos, Alex, and Clarissa were already moving toward the common corridor, Bobby trotting to catch up to them. Naomi put her hand on Saba's arm. "The false identities don't have to hold up long. We're close to doing this. No despair." Saba's eyes softened. "My lady wife is back in Seoul leading the fight against these bastards, and I will move worlds to wake up beside her again. Just once more." Naomi thought of Jim, and the ache of fear in her stomach. Saba touched her shoulder and pushed her gently away toward her friends, her crew, her family, less one. The inner layer of Medina's drum could have been any of the old spin stations, wider, common corridors with room for carts and foot traffic both. Ramps that led up toward the soil and false sun of the inner face, or down toward the vacuum beneath her feet. She hadn't stepped outside Saba's hidden den since they'd lost Jim. Now, walking with the normal inhabitants of Medina, trying to fit in with the mid-shift patterns, she kept noticing how open everything felt. In another context, it might have been a relief. Now it left her feeling exposed as a mouse in cat territory. She plucked up the terminal that Saba had given her, trying to look bored as she checked who she was, where she lived, all the answers she'd need to give the Laconians if she was stopped. She'd seen plenty of faked identities before, and this one was decent. The real question was how deeply Saba's moles had been able to get into the Laconian datasets. With the link between Medina and the storm severed, they'd be working from local copies, corruptible ones. Odd to think that without Jim's sacrifice, the underground might have ended right then. Her gratitude was complicated by anger. Wide screens showed the station newsfeed. Laconian propaganda, but maybe true, some of it. They were playing images of Sol system and the war there. She didn't watch that, but when it shifted, she paused. A young woman with olive skin and a wide jaw in Laconian blues. The text below her said, "Admiral Jae-un Song of the Eye of the Typhoon." And on the other side of the screen, a young man, Santiago Singh, governor of Medina. "What are your hopes for your arrival at Medina Station?" he asked, the subtitles in Spanish, Chinese, and, unnervingly, Belter Creole. The woman nodded seriously and answered, "The important thing is that we ensure the safety of the people on the station. High Consul Duarte has made it very, very clear that..." Naomi didn't realize she'd stopped until Amos prodded her.
"Should probably keep moving, boss. Less attention."
"Yes," Naomi said. "It's editing," Clarissa said. "They do it all the time." "That's not what the light delay really is. There's still time." Naomi nodded. She didn't trust herself to speak. Her name, according to Saba's faked ID, was Ami Henders, and her address was listed as refugee housing on level 4.
She was supposed to be the pilot of the Blue Genius, a water hauler presently burning somewhere on the far side of the Athens Gate without her. She wondered whether Saba had been able to scrub Naomi Nagata from the station records. He wouldn't have been able to get her out of decades of newsfeed footage, standing behind Jim and wishing the cameras were elsewhere. She was walking on the surface of a soap bubble, and hoping it wouldn't pop. The refugee quarters, when they reached them, were a little better than living in the underground had been. A little suite of 5 rooms with a narrow common hall and a shared head at the end. She could have touched one wall with her elbow and the other with her shoulder. It was tighter than their quarters on the Rosie, but with doors, so they could sleep without breathing each other's dreams. A little monitor in the wall was set to the official news feed, but the captain of the Typhoon was gone, replaced by a sober-faced man in a security uniform. "The base was exactly what we thought we would find. These rat holes are what allowed the terrorists to function and plan in secret. Without them, they'll be forced out into the light. That's where they can be stopped. We don't know how many people were using the secret base, but we've cordoned it off, and we're making a full investigation. We feel certain that the threat to the station is reduced, but we can't be complacent. These people are willing to risk the integrity of the environment for their ideological purity. Risk the lives of the whole station. It's important that we isolate and disarm these terrorists before another attack like the one on the oxygen tank. With that in mind, the governor has authorized a limited amnesty for anyone who..." Clarissa turned the monitor off with her thumb. She met Naomi's eyes, and the determination and exhaustion in them was clearer than words could have been. "Let it go. We have work to do." Alex cleared his throat. "Well, since there's no galley anymore, I guess I'll head down the hallway and see if I can't find a coffee shop or something. Anybody else need breakfast?" There would be guards. There would be drones. There would be the risk that trying to pay for something would collapse Alex's false identity or flag his real one. She wanted to grab him and lock him in his room. She wanted to make sure no one left the uncertain safety of their cabin. "Tea," she said. "Maybe some protein cakes." "All right," Alex said. "I'll be back." The way he said it made it a promise, as if he could keep it. "I'm gonna," Amos said, gesturing to Clarissa. Naomi nodded. "I'll get some work done." "That leaves me for watch," Bobby said with a lopsided smile. "Not much of a plan, but it isn't nothing." "I'll get you a plan," Naomi said. Sitting alone on her new, thin bunk, she built a list on Saba's terminal. If she thought too much about the dangers, the time pressure, she knew the dark thoughts would start coming. There wasn't time for that. If she could focus, though, problem-solve, she'd be okay. She'd known herself long enough to learn that. The care and feeding of a well-used mind. The final goal was to get out of the slow zone and find someplace safe to hide and regroup. So, the last step was at the top of the list. Regroup. She didn't have the details of what that would look like. Probably keep her head down and see what happened. Wait for the enemy to stumble or new allies to appear. The old, old strategies. But whatever shape it took, that was the final goal. In order for that to happen, they would have to manage some other things. Reach safety. Before that, identify safety. After all, they'd need to know where they were fleeing to before they fled. It had to be someplace that they could land the Rosie, someplace that wasn't likely to fall in line with Duarte and turn them in. So none of Fisk's association worlds, and not Saul either. That was tricky, but she felt the beginnings of some ideas for it. So all right. But there was more than one dependency for that. So she split the column and added the other track. Blind Medina and Gathering Storm. If the Laconians knew where they'd gone, they wouldn't stay hidden long, so that would be important. And it would be the last thing they did before they left, so the enemy wouldn't have time to fix whatever they chose to break. She'd have to have everyone ready to go before the sensor arrays went down, so gather evacuation groups. And in order to do that, they'd have to get the word to everyone in Saba's networks. All the underground. All of them. And there it was. The sorrow and the fear. And the tightness at the back of her throat. It was all right. She just had to put it on her list. It was part of the plan. Save Jim. Saba sent a message an hour before. Ami Henders was supposed to get off her shift. Bobby got the same message, though none of the others did. It was a restaurant, just one level under the drum's inner surface, and a route to reach it that would, if everything went well, avoid any checkpoints. Naomi washed her face in the little sink, no wider than her two palms together, and tugged her hair into something like order. When she got home to the Rosie, she was going to spend a day in the showers. A whole damned day. Alex and Clarissa were waiting for her in the public hall. Bobby and Amos were a few meters down, pretending to talk, but actually keeping watch. They were both bruised, and there was a cut over Amos's eye. They looked like they'd been caught in the explosion, which was technically true, but the tension that had been showing in the way Amos held his gut and shoulders was gone. No, not gone, but lessened. That was good. "We ready to paint the town red?" Clarissa asked, taking Naomi's arm. It had the form of a playful gesture, but the need for support was there, too.
"I hope this place serves margaritas," Alex said. "It's been a long time since I had a good margarita." "Trust me when I say you've never had a good margarita, Martian," Amos replied. "Still, some things only Earth does well."
Bobby caught Naomi's eye, gave a little nod, and started off along the route. Amos walked at her side, his steps rolling a little in the fractional gravity, like something hurt with each step. Naomi gave them a few seconds and then started after them. There was a story behind those bruises, and she had the impression she'd never know what it was. James Holden had shipped with five others on his crew, but they weren't five. They were a couple up ahead, and a different group of three behind. As ways to avoid pattern recognition, it was thin, but it was something. The restaurant was a wide, white ceramic bar open to the corridor. Billows of steam came from the back, rich with the smells of fish and curry. The design didn't fit into the aesthetic of the original ship. The space was a modification. The Nauvoo, which became the Behemoth, which became Medina Station in the process of learning what it was and would be. Looked at that way, Naomi liked the restaurant, even if it was a little ugly. The man behind the counter nodded, greeted them all in a dialect Naomi didn't recognize, and waved them back into the steam. The kitchen was small, with two women, one very old, the other hardly more than a girl, who looked at them curiously as they passed through. The old man opened a thick metal door and nodded, smiling at the walk-in freezer beyond it. Saba was already there, a blanket over his shoulders and a thin black cigarette in his mouth. His cheeks were ruddy with the cold. The man closed the door behind them, and a golden emergency light came on, throwing shadows across them from crates of vat-raised fish. Amos's gaze cut over to Clarissa, but, if anything, she seemed to be enjoying the cold.
"Not perfect," Saba said, "but hard for them to hear us."
"You think they're listening?"
"No," Saba said.
But here seems less likely I'm wrong.
Pardon for the fast change. I didn't have much warning.
Shikata ga nai, Naomi said, and Saba nodded ruefully.
We have a plan, Bobby said. Well, Naomi does.
The outline of one, anyway, Naomi said. I don't love it, because a lot of things have to happen in a very small time frame. But the typhoon arrives in less than a week, and slowing that down isn't something I can do.
I have people, Saba said. You tell me, I'll tell who needs telling.
There's just a lot of moving parts, Naomi said. Lots of ways for things to break down.
Tell me a story, Saba said through a cloud of smoke and visible breath.
Naomi did. She went through step by step, detail by detail. As she talked, the whole operation solidified in her mind, letting her speak with a clarity and authority she only halfway felt. It was a terrible plan, open to 1,000 different failures, and some of them wouldn't be things they could recover from. If the assault team couldn't get onto the storm, if the kill code was changed or unhackable, if the Laconian repair crews could get the sensors fixed more quickly than she expected. But with every word she spoke, with every detail she provided, she felt the typhoon looming behind her, coming close, ending any chance they had.
"Gonna need 2 bombs," Saba said, pulling up his hand terminal. The one that didn't connect to the station's legitimate network. He talked as he composed a message. One for sensors, one for the jail. Katria is good for one. Have to see who she likes for 2. Which one matters more?
They both matter, Naomi said at the same moment Clarissa said. The jail.
I worked on this station back in the day, Clarissa said. Get me access to the secondary power junction that feeds them and a way to reset the primary. I can keep the sensors down.
Claire, Bobby said, concern in her voice.
I'm good for it, Clarissa said. It will work.
And then that was decided. Saba was already putting a message into his hand terminal.
Bis bien, Alice, he said.
Amos and I are dealing with the storm, Bobby said. You give us a team, but we're point or no deal.
Deal, Saba said. I'll put me and mine on the Malaclips as soon as the signal goes. If the muscle here has trouble, at least there can be 2 against the 1. Plan B, Sasa?
Alex raised his hand. No one's flying the Rossi on this but me. We all knew that, right?
I'll take the jail, Naomi said. I'll get Jim.
Saba's terminal chirped, and he looked at it with pleasure.
Katria has someone. Koyo with experience in demolitions. He'll need to know what we're doing. Just his part, though.
Inner circle, us.
Inner circle, Naomi said. Claire and I can meet with him.
Good,
Saba said, as he trundled to the freezer door and pounded on it with a blanket-wrapped fist. Then he pointed to Bobby and Amos.
You come with me. We'll see Katria. Talk about how to hunt Marines.
Something flickered over Bobby's face. Hardly even an expression, but Naomi saw it.
You'll lead, we'll follow, Amos said, smiling his empty smile. Any thoughts on how to get me onto my ship?
Alex asked as the door opened.
Several, Saba said.
You should come with.
Then he shook his head.
Too many things. Not enough time.
They stepped out into the suddenly burning air. Naomi hadn't even noticed she was getting cold until suddenly she wasn't anymore. Saba led them out to the kitchen, and then they slipped through the steam and into the civilian world, 2 by 2, until she and Clarissa were all that remained. They sat at the counter and watched people go by. The fish was unremarkable, but the curry and mushroom rice actually were good. Across the corridor, a monitor spooled out the news feed until it repeated. Clarissa ate, drank tea,
talked about everything and nothing. Naomi almost didn't notice the tremble in the other woman's hand or the way her eyes jittered sometimes. If she thinks she can do it, she can do it, Naomi told herself. The man arrived, sliding into the chair beside them. Dark, handsome eyes and a bright, excited smile, with a crooked nose between them.
Namnena Jodao, he said. Seen you both back at home, yeah?
I remember, Clarissa said.
Katria, she sent me, he said,
then leaned forward.
So, what is it we're going to do?
Chapter 41 Sing. He had trained on ships back home, as anyone at his rank would. He'd spent weeks sleeping in a tight cabin and eating elbow to elbow with his fellow officers. But at the end of training, he went home, back to Laconia and Natalia and the monster. The weekends after a training run had been some of the best he'd ever had, waking up late with Natalia beside him. Before the monster came, they'd had quarters with a bedroom on the third story and a folding wall that they could pull back to get fresh air and the view. He remembered lying in that bed, looking out over the city as twilight fell. Vast clouds turning gold and violet on the horizon, and the alien construction platforms glittering among the stars. He'd laid his head against Natalia's as yet unoccupied belly, and thought about the ships being made up above the planet's atmosphere. How one day he might command one. It had seemed glorious at the time. He'd known without checking the dates when his exile on Medina Station had lasted as long as a full training tour. Something in the back of his mind had been anticipating the end of low ceilings and false skies. Each day he found himself growing more anxious. And it wasn't only the threat from local terrorists or the mounting pressure he felt to reopen the traffic through the gates. It was his flesh itself, grown accustomed to these long isolations having an end, expecting relief and not getting it, wanting his wife and his child and their sky, even as his conscious mind knew the first two would come much later, and the last, perhaps never. It was possible that he would live his whole life and die as the governor of Medina Station, and never see a real cloud again. He'd known that from the moment he'd met with the High Consul, all those months ago. It hadn't started chafing until just now. The draft of his monthly report was open on his monitor, his personal journal inset in a smaller window. Everyone above him in the chain of command could see his journal if they chose to, but his report gave him the chance to summarize his experiences, to say what, from his perspective, was important. His fingers hovered over his keyboard, where they had been since the memory of Natalia and their old bedroom and the clouds had intruded on his thoughts. He wished he could pause longer. Many of the locals persist in referring to the transfer of control in Sol's system as a war. This kind of rhetoric has emboldened dissident factions on Medina Station. Given the escalating violence employed by the dissidents, I have elected to maintain the closed gate policy until the arrival of the typhoon. Ships coming in from the colonial systems have too great a potential to smuggle in relief supplies and reinforcements for the recalcitrant elements here. He paused again. A small, angry voice in the back of his mind said, "In the event of another large-scale attack on the station, I recommend pulling Laconian forces back to the storm and venting Medina Station." He pushed the thought away without writing it down. It wasn't only that it was immoral, though that should have been enough. It was also a statement of weakness, an admission that he could not cut the rot out of this tree without burning it all. And still, the elegance of it made it hard to turn away. If Holden and his allies had been held to truly Laconian standards, they would be dead. It was that simple. If Singh treated them with the respect and dignity with which Duarte treated him, to which Singh held himself, removing them all from the equation would just be proper discipline. But he had grown to understand that they weren't Laconian. Not yet. They hadn't had time to understand the necessity of the Empire. Holden's arguments were more than proof of that. He had to be patient with them. Firm, but patient. He had to keep them from hurting themselves or others until the ripples of this admittedly vast change had calmed, until the new patterns of life had become normal for them. While I am certain that James Holden knows more of the local dissident factions than he is presently admitting, he is not our only resource on that matter. His experience and expertise in the anomaly that Admiral Trejo reported make him a genuinely unique asset on that issue. For that reason, I have chosen to break off his interrogation here and remove him immediately to Laconia for debriefing in whatever context the High Council considers most appropriate. Meaning that the terrorist figurehead would see Laconia before he did. Might even come across Natalia and the monster before they came out to Medina, if the High Council chose to treat him gently. Holden would smell the rain, see the sunrise, and Singh would be here, in this spinning can in an eerie non-space that didn't even have stars to make it feel like home. It was a deep irony that being a prisoner and being in power could be so mismatched. "Damn it," he said to his empty office, then leaned back, running one hand across his scalp. There was so much more to put into the report. The preparations he'd made, was making, for the stationing of the typhoon and the additional personnel that it was bringing to Medina. The victories he'd had in rooting out the bombers and repairing the damage they had done. His schedule for coordinating and controlling the traffic between the worlds. The Empire would succeed or fail on the back of its logistical planning, and his implementation of the High Council's vision was actually quite detailed. Only just now, something itched in his soul, and he couldn't concentrate. He wondered whether Duarte ever suffered the same base animal distractions. It seemed he would have, but Singh couldn't imagine it. He closed the draft report, opened his personal journal wide enough to edit, and then closed it too. The walls themselves seemed to push the air at him. It was like an optical illusion of something falling that never quite fell. "Damn it," he said again, less forcefully this time. The reports coming in from Saul were distracting, too. Trejo's private reports tracked through the gathering storm, but they were meant for Duarte. Singh wished he could read them himself. There were so many questions. Whether the Tempest had taken any lasting damage in its first foray against the enemy, whether anything had changed with the anomaly that had appeared after Pallas, when Trejo anticipated the next battle would come, and if he believed it would be the last one. There were the public feeds, of course. The positions of the combined navies were, for the most part, a known thing. The larger cruisers were impossible to hide, and the massive Union ships they called void cities. But there might be stealth ships lying in wait, or fields of torpedoes launched into a quiet orbit, counting on the vastness of space to conceal them until they burned to life. Just looking at the declassified tactical map made Singh's flesh crawl. The vast cloud of the enemy shifting through the gravity-bent space of inner planets like a swarm of insects with a single hated enemy, and the Tempest alone in its simple course. Trejo wouldn't evade, and he wouldn't retreat. He had his orders, and he would follow them. Singh reminded himself of how powerful the Tempest was, how resilient. The High Consul wouldn't have committed the ship to a path that led to embarrassment for the Empire and death for Trejo. And yet, what if he'd miscalculated? Or what if Earth or Mars or the Union had been behind the wave of lost time? Or, the speculation was pointless. Worse, it was self-indulgent. Even if he knew everything else he needed to put into his official report, it was going to have to wait. He had to get out of his offices, if only for a while. He had to collect himself. Overstreet answered the connection request almost at once.
Governor?
I will need a security detail to my office at once. Overstreet's silence was less than a heartbeat.
Is there a problem, sir?
No. I want to inspect the docks. When will there be sufficient security for that? If Overstreet was surprised or annoyed, there was no sign of it in his voice.
I'll have a detail to you in 5 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Singh said, then dropped the connection. The Lightbreaker was a cargo ship that had been in the Union's fleet. A small vessel, but fast and with an efficient drive. All of the ships and their crews were guests of the Empire until the Typhoon arrived, but not the Lightbreaker. Of all the ships on the station manifest, that was the one best suited to act as a prisoner transport. It was slated to push off in half an hour's time, with James Holden in its brig, and a crew Singh had chosen from the gathering storm. And Singh found he very much wanted to be there when the first ship left Medina Station for Laconia. The first transit to happen while he was in charge of the ring space, his watch. He straightened his uniform and checked himself in the mirror before stepping smartly into the outer offices. He heard the change when he walked into the room. The men and women under his command, making certain that he saw them busy. 8 Marines in armor were waiting outside, along with a driver, who wasn't in power armor but did carry an assault rifle beside her in the cart.
"The dock, sir?" the driver asked.
"Berth K-18, Singh said, then sat back as the cart started off. The Marine escort loped along as fast as the cart could drive, and with the sense that they weren't anywhere near an uncomfortable pace. The hallway had been cleared, and guards stood at the intersections with weapons drawn. It was like traveling through the dream of a tube station that had grown out in all directions until there wasn't even the promise of finding a way up to the surface. A woman with a heart-shaped face peered past the guard's shoulder, straining to catch a glimpse of him, and Singh waved at her. Let the civilians see that their governor was here, not hiding away in his office. If he wasn't scared of the terrorists, the loyal faction of the population wouldn't be either, or less so, anyway. And still, he did wonder how many of those people he passed would have been as happy to see him dead. He wondered if the girl with the heart-shaped face would have shot him if she'd had the chance. There was no way to be certain. Would never be a way to be totally certain. Or at least, no way other than... At the end of the drum, they left the spin gravity behind. The Marines shifted gracefully into a protective star formation with him at its center. He had seen images of the terrorists' attack, twisted metal and shattered ceramic, flakes of carbon lace floating in the air like black snow. Passing through the space now, what struck him was the stink of it. Welding torches and burning lubricant oil, overheated wiring, and the back-of-the-throat bitterness of exhausted fire suppressants. They did this to their own station. Just spite me, he thought. And then, no, not their own. Mine. This, more than anything else, proves they can't be trusted with the future. This station is mine. They passed by the crowd of people waiting for permission to visit their ships, The Marines alert for any sign of violence and passed by without so much as a scowl. At the berth, the guards held Holden at the airlock, assuming that Singh had come because he wanted to inspect the prisoner before he left. On the float, Holden looked younger. The lines in his face softened, and his hair stood wildly out from his head. He could see what the man had looked like as a boy. Singh nodded. "Governor?" Holden said. He made it just polite enough to make it clear he was impatient without actually demanding offense be taken. "Captain Holden, I wish you a safe journey." "Thanks. Laconia is a beautiful place. Not sure I'm going to be seeing the nice parts of it, but I'm open for a pleasant surprise." "If you cooperate with the High Council, you will be treated well," Singh said. "We are an honorable people. No matter what you think, we were never your enemy." Holden's smile was weary. "Okay. That's bullshit, but I'm too tired to fight about it," he thought. Singh nodded, and the guards guided the prisoner away. The airlock closed behind him. 15 minutes later, the lightbreaker left dock and burned hard for the Laconia gate, with Holden aboard. Singh heard Overstreet's report in the security office rather than his own. The walls were a pleasantly neutral gray-green that matched everything. The only decorations were a small potted fern and a framed piece of calligraphy in red, black, and gold that listed the High Council's 9 moral tenets. Overstreet himself sat behind his desk with a physical solidity that made it seem like he'd grown there. Singh stood looking down at the man, rather than take the seat and posture of a visitor. It might be Overstreet's office, but it was all Singh's station. "I'm expecting some unrest after the news comes back from Seoul," Overstreet said. "People don't like seeing their team lose. I'm trying to get ahead of that. Channel it into something we can control, not let it turn into something that can gain momentum." "That's wise. Are you seeing a reaction to the news about the underground losing their hiding place?" "Not among the general population, no. But it meant a lot to the security force. We knew it was here someplace, but actually finding the hub and shutting it down, it's a major step forward. Without a physically isolated space, it's hard for the terrorists to coordinate, and it lets us move into the next phase, identification." "How many have you found?" Singh asked. Overstreet spread his massive hands. 15, for certain. Maybe 20. The level of internal corruption within the local population can't be understated. My best estimate is that a third of our operating personnel are at least open to working against us." Singh let the assessment sit for a moment, watching his outrage at the ingratitude and arrogance of the locals flare like it was happening outside himself. When he was sure he wouldn't curse, he spoke. "That's unacceptable," Singh said. "Changing that has to be a top priority." "Didn't mean to suggest I was accepting it. Just reporting in on where it stood. I've put in double and triple checks, random audits, all the internal security procedures I can, but this is going to be something we struggle with until we start getting regular commerce open again. Once we can start breaking up the old guard here, I expect to see these problems fall away. Wash out the bad, bring in the new. Like that." Singh made a small sound of acknowledgement, neither approval nor condemnation. "The dock attack was what led us to their nest," Overstreet said. "But even there, I'm fairly sure some information isn't getting passed up the chain to us." "And where do we stand on that investigation?" Overstreet's ice-blue eyes looked away. "Permission to speak freely, Governor." "Granted. It'd be going a lot better if you hadn't shipped my best resource back home. Holden was central to the conspiracy,
The man's a murderer. And I'm still not 100% certain what the aim of the attack was.
To damage the storm while it was still in dock, Singh said.
Maybe, Overstreet said.
But why?
In preparation for something?
Or was it to degrade the oxygen supply and force us to open shipping before we're ready?
Or was it to destroy the air gap server or the secondary power storage or one of the 8 warehouses that got scraped out by the blast? Or was it just a propaganda move to make Laconia Rule look weak or provoke a crackdown as a way to recruit new insurgents?
It did all of those things, Singh said. But which ones it intended matters, sir. Understanding the mind of the enemy is what lets me do my job.
Singh heard the frustration in Overstreet's tone. That was fair. Part of his error in removing Tanaka had been putting Overstreet into position without the training and preparation time he should have had. And with the underground running circles around them, the man couldn't feel he was doing a good job. Nothing degraded morale like the sense that the potential for excellence was being denied. Happily, Singh was in a position to address that point right away. He took out his hand terminal, opened the message that had occasioned this particular visit, took off his personal security encryption, and passed it to Overstreet. The young man appeared on Overstreet's monitor. Wide, slightly feverish eyes, unruly hair. The lens and the perspective made the bent nose seem larger than it actually was.
"Hoi, Bosmang. Something big going down," Jodao said.
"I only got my part, but it's about the sensor arrays.
Parle, Tuime, but keep it quiet. Voltaire finds out I know you, and you'll see my water in your faucets, yeah?"
Overstreet's eyes narrowed to slivers of ice. His lips had thinned to a single dark line.
"Well, that's interesting," he said.
"The Belters aren't the only ones with a network," Singh said.
"Not anymore.
See that your debriefing isn't observed. This time, we'll be ahead of the bastards."
"May mean pulling personnel off the engineering investigation," Overstreet said.
"This is the most important thing now," Singh said. Overstreet nodded slowly, lost in thoughts and calculations of his own. When he sighed, it was like a dying man's breath.
"We're holding this station with just the crew we carried out here on the gathering storm, and a few extras that Admiral Trejo could spare us. And this station is a damn lot bigger than our ship was."
"Is that a problem for you, Overstreet?"
"It's just that we do have a great selection of number one priorities. Don't we, sir?"
Chapter 42. Drummer.
"And if you fail to turn back," Secretary General Lee said, "we will be forced to respond with force. There will be no further warnings."
"He looks good," Laughlin said. "Statesmanlike." Drummer thought he looked sad, which actually came off pretty well, all things considered. It made it seem as if it was the impending loss of life that had dragged his spirits down. She was fairly certain that if she'd done the announcement, it would have come off as anger, or fear, or a near psychosis-inducing lack of sleep. She went back in the spooled message and watched it again. The line had been drawn where everyone had known it would. Point Luktra, 2.1 AU from the sun. By conventions of mining law and centuries of precedent, that placed the heart of the tempest inside the asteroid belt, an invisible line in space, unmarked by anything more than what people believed about it. And that was enough. The combined fleet of the EMC and her union hadn't played coy. They had burned and braked to reach this position. 237 ships, ranging from the void cities to traffic control skiffs. Anything with a gun was spread across the surface of a modified parabola with one focus on the Tempest's flight path. The ships on her side might shift and evade, but everything the Secretary General had said was for the news feeds and posterity. Anyone with a map and a half a semester of military history could have drawn accurate conclusions without him. She wondered if Saba would see it back on Medina. She wondered if he was still alive. There hadn't been a reply to her desperate question about the time slip, and the Tempest showed every sign of ignoring the EMC's warning. Drummer went from optimism that Cameron Tour was right, that the Laconians wouldn't dare use their magnetic matter-ripping beam for fear of its mysterious side effects, to expecting time to stutter, stop, and come back with the fleet already in ruins. If she died here, would Saba see it? Would the official Laconian news feeds be how they said goodbye? Laughlin changed the display to the tactical map. The hundreds of green dots that were their fleet, including the one that was people's home. The single orange blip that was their doom. As a piece of abstract art, it looked like something a student would have come up with at lower university. If she'd ever thought to put together a visual display that said destined to fail, it would have been that small, glowing bit of orange. But still, somewhere, when she'd still been working security contracts, she'd seen an interview with an old, smiling imam whose name she didn't remember. The one thing he'd said that stuck with her was, "I am a human being. Anything that happens to human beings could happen to me." One time and another in the years since, she'd taken comfort from that, or warning. People fall in love, so maybe I will too. People get jobs, so maybe I will too. And people get sick. People have accidents. And now, she supposed, people are divided from their families by war and history. And so that could happen to me, too. Even when they won, would it mean she would wake up beside Saba again? There were so many variations of victory and loss. "They're confident, aren't they?" Laughlin said, leaning back in his chair. "It's astounding." "I suppose it is," she said. She didn't know where his mind had been, but it had clearly been somewhere different from her own. "You should probably get to the transport." Laughlin's smile was rueful. "Is there anything you'd like me to pass on?" "No," Drummer said. "Anything that needs saying, I'll say after." Or, she didn't say, not at all. That part was understood. As with Palace Station and Independence, the plan was to evacuate the civilian population before the violence began. Ships had been docking with people's home for days now, hauling off families that had lived there for years and taking them to Mars and Earth, Luna and the Lagrange stations, or any of the thousand little holes in the belt that could still hold air. Going to the docks with Laughlin now was like walking through a graveyard. The wide, curving hall should have been filled with people. Music and voices should have echoed down through the common parks, the transfer tubes, the docks. Even the air smelled different, closer and musty as the recyclers shifted down to match their reduced loads. She gave Laughlin points for waiting until near the end. Most of the EMC political types in his staff had been among the first out, just after families with children. The lines of refugees waiting to leave were all older people now, the staff and citizenry that didn't have the skills to help in a battle, all with small bags floating beside them. Overnight bags, many of them.
as if they might be coming right back. There was a lot of laughter in the line, and a sense of anticipation that bordered on feverish. Part of her wanted